I'm so sick of the way that we've been portrayed. I refuse to let that make me sit in anger. I have to act, and that's something I've always done.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back?
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
There are many different kinds of activists. There are angry activists. There are fearful activists. There are grateful activists. There are disappointed activists. Every once in a while, you meet a positive, optimistic, happy activist. And while I don't know how people do it, there's something so immensely contagious when you meet someone who can scream their lungs out and yet do so with a smile and with grace and really showing the world that we are the best we can be. And I'm so immensely grateful to have one of those people here. So here I am with Amanda Markowitz.
That was the nicest introduction I've ever received. That made me emotional.
I mean it. There's something about you that is so incredibly positive and optimistic, and yet you're dealing with very, very serious stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's just a part of how I was raised.
What does that mean? How were you raised?
So most people know who follow along my journey that I'm the granddaughter of four Holocaust survivors. And, you know, three out of the four were in Auschwitz and multiple concentration camps. One was fighting in the forest, but they lost a lot of their family and friends and came from really beautiful lives and ultimately went through this horrific darkness and came out on the other side and went on to live beautiful lives again. And for me, I think that has to, you know, I've been raised in that way of, you know, there's generational trauma, but there's also generational survival. And we as a people have this instinct to also survive. And I think if you sit in the darkness, it takes so much from you. And instead, it's just better to be appreciative, for me at least, and for my family, to appreciate everything we have, because we came from a family that lost everything and came to the United States with $0 in their pocket. So I'm grateful every day. Every day is a gift.
But that's a very interesting take, because someone else could have told the exact same story that you just told and said, I know how horrible human beings can be. I know how dark the world can be. And I am angry and frustrated and maybe even feel guilty when I have fun.
Yes, I get that. And I certainly, you know, with everything going on and after October 7th, I am not going to lie, I was very angry. I could barely function. And I, you know, as a mother, it was impossible to, you know, try to parent my children. And I was very angry for a long time. And then as it went on, I realized I can't just sit in this. I have to act. And in order for me to act, it has to come from a place that ignites me. And that is the instinct to survive and promote our people in a very positive light. Because I'm so sick of the way that we've been portrayed that I refuse to let that, you know, make me sit in anger. Instead, it makes me need to get out in the light and make sure everyone knows who we are and those values of Tikkun Olam and, you know, repairing the world and doing good. I mean, that's what I've been taught. You know, we're all equal, find humanity, and that's something I've always done.
Yeah. So Amanda, this is the question that I begin every episode with, which is, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm that survival's in my DNA Jew.
I'm that survival's in my DNA Jew. Expand.
I'm not gonna be a Jew on trembling knees. I'm gonna fight. I'm gonna fight for our people, but I'm gonna do it in a way that is somehow positive, that is supportive of our people, that is inclusive, that is going to make people feel good and proud to be Jewish and going to portray Jews in a light that is so positive that people can't help but be allies because they see the truth, they see who we are.
So how do you fight? What have you been doing?
I have been doing everything I can.
Yeah.
I use my words and I try to use them very specifically. I share my thoughts. I turned my platform on social media completely into activism for Holocaust education, Israel advocacy, fighting misinformation, you know, promoting the Jewish people and who we really are. And it's something I'm so proud of. It's the most challenging and meaningful work I've ever done. And at the same time, I attend a lot of events because I think it's really important to have community. You know, that's another thing is like when my grandparents came here, there was something called the Ludger Club, and it was all Jews from Ludge originally, Ludge, Poland.
Ludge is it was a big town in Poland with a very substantial Jewish population who was almost entirely exterminated.
Yes, exactly. I believe there were 200,000 Ludge Jews before the war, and after I think 20,000, very much.
That's 90%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jews made up a third of the population in Ludge before World War II. They were a thriving community and then decimated.
So your grandparents arrived here.
And my grandfather was actually the president of this Ludger Club. But it was so that they could go through this common experience with survivors. Like they had to create a community for themselves so that they would have that support, and going through this shared experience was really helpful. And I think that's what I instinctually did recently, is I needed to create and have a community where I felt it was a safe space. I felt that people were, you know, seeing truth and thinking critically and supporting each other and, you know, fighting the same fight.
So tell me a little bit about your community or communities that you've created for yourself since October 7.
I found that the community happened pretty quickly through social media. There was a bunch of us that started being vocal and we quickly somehow connected. I made a lot of friends after October 7th on social media, and including you.
Yeah.
You reached out to me and we formed a friendship that way as well. And, you know, I wanted to support people. I would hear someone was experiencing some form of hatred. I would reach out to them on social media and say, you know, I know you don't know me, but I want to help you and I want you to feel supported. And, you know, I would maybe make sure there was an event put together, make sure they had the support they needed. It was really important to me to create a community. And then later, like I do these videos through the Holocaust Museum that I had pitched them this idea of bringing influencers and influential people to the museum for these heart-to-heart conversations to increase visibility, not only on the museum, but in Holocaust education.
And we should note, this is in the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum.
Holocaust Museum, LA.
Yeah.
And the community I had built, immediately all those people said yes, and they came, and we've had hundreds of thousands of views on these videos, and it's made people very aware and, you know, increased visitorship on the museum significantly. And I just feel like we've created this community that we go to bat for each other. It's been incredibly beneficial. I think it's what's gotten me through everything.
Why do you think you waited, and in a sense I've waited, many of us have waited, to form a community only after something as atrocious as October 7th happened, and then also then in the United States, what people call October 8th happened? Why did we wait so long to form a community? Your grandparents came here and it sounds like they immediately formed their community. What got lost?
I will say that before October 7th, I was already involved in Holocaust education, and my family owns a deli here in Los Angeles called Bachter's Famous Deli. And so I was always around a very Jewish community growing up. I already had a very significant Jewish community. But in my professional life, it wasn't the same. And I knew it was something I was always kind of craving. I experienced different things, and different things said to me that was like, wow, I feel like a real minority here and I don't feel comfortable. And I think after October 7th...
Before we get to after October 7th,
yeah.
Do you have examples? When have you felt like, using your word, a real minority? Which, by the way, is something that I've heard other people say, the word real minority, as if we aren't real and we have to...
Yeah, because we've never been perceived that way. And I feel like I've spent so long trying to explain to people that we are a minority. We're 0.2% of the population. I don't think people really realize how great of a minority we are. And I don't think anyone realized still doesn't realize.
But still, I don't understand why we need to explain that we're a real minority. No other minority, to my knowledge, walks around telling the world or the country or the city or the industry or whatever what percentage they are.
I know.
What have you experienced as a quote-unquote real minority? What were your experiences before October 7th?
I mean, I definitely have felt like, for sure, growing up, it was like I was a member of different communities, and it'd be like Hanukkah was an afterthought for sure. Everything was Christmas, and then it was like this tiny menorah on a table, and Hanukkah was almost like comical. Like, I always showed up to holiday parties in my like Hanukkah attire, and everyone knew me as like this token Jew, and I was proud of it, but it was almost like comical to other people. And it didn't feel great. And then...
And by the way, we should say that you're in the film industry?
Yeah, I've been an actor and a producer.
Okay, yeah.
And I remember I was told... I wrote an article and it was published, and it was about my trip to Auschwitz on March of the Living, and how, it's a crazy story, and how I got pregnant there. And it was like...
Getting pregnant after Auschwitz.
It was this hilarious... It's a really... beautiful article.
You got pregnant. I want to assume, just to be clear.
My husband's going to be like, again, you're telling this story?
No. But I want to be clear. So you're not misunderstood. You didn't get pregnant at Auschwitz.
No, but okay. I did get pregnant after visiting. Like
after visiting on the trip.
Pretty close. I had no choice. We had been trying to unsuccessfully have a baby. And the timing just worked out that's when I had to try. And it was like, so my husband also is the grandson of 4 Holocaust survivors. So our grandparents, 8 Holocaust survivors, 6 of whom were at Auschwitz.
So your kids, basically their entire ancestry is from the Holocaust, 7 out of 8 Auschwitz.
8 great grandparents that are Holocaust survivors.
Wow.
6 of whom were at Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we visited, it was obviously very emotional for us. And it's like, all right, well, this is the timing and we got to figure this out. So, but there's something, it was odd, of course, but there's something really beautiful about the fact that like I had been trying to get pregnant and was unsuccessful. And then I got pregnant after that. And it's just like life from, again, it's like how it follows me, like finding the light in this darkness, bringing forth life. That's the biggest like F you, right? Like, yeah. You did this thing. Well, I'm creating more Jewish generations to come.
Amazing. It's true Jewish resilience.
It's complete resilience.
I can't stop by being reminded of my grandfather from my mother's side, Saba Karol, who every time that he would go to a funeral or an annual visit to a cemetery, he would immediately get hungry and go and have a huge steak at a restaurant. And then when he passed away when I was about 11, ever since, we would go to his funeral, and then years later when my grandmother passed away, her funeral and their annual Remembrance Day, and we would get so hungry and we would go and celebrate, right? It's this contrast between you Jewish suffering, Jewish grief, and then Jewish happiness and Jewish resilience.
Wait,
And they are linked. They're not different. When we cry, we cry. But when we have fun, we have fun.
Yes.
And if that means making more Jewish babies, that's what you did.
Yes, absolutely. And I can get into it later, but that was very apparent to me on my recent trip to Israel, which was really important for me to see that resilience. But no, so I wrote this article, and it was published in Kfeller, which you maybe know. And I had sat in a room of peers. Someone asked, I don't know how it got brought up, but I said, you know, I recently was published, and they said, what publication? And I said, Kfeller. And everyone like laughed. And then someone was like, of course, that's where you got published. And I was like...
So tell just for people, what is Kfeller?
What is what?
What? Tell us about the publication itself.
Oh, so they are, you know, they do Jewish forward stories, you know, a lot of different stories relating around Judaism, and it's like modern and fun, and they have, you know, cool angles on things, and they're in social media, and they are a great resource, and I love their stuff. And I was really proud to be featured. And
it is very, you know, anti-Semitism, dismissal of Jews, hatred of Jews comes in all different shapes and forms. And, you know, even saying something like, yeah, of course you're a Jew, so of course you got published in this Jewish thing, immediately dismisses you, not just as your identity, but it also dismisses your merit. Like, you know, there are many Jews who don't get published, just as there are many non-Jews who don't get published.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You don't get a free ticket just because you're Jewish. And yet,
Yeah, and I even had pushed a long time to include anti-Semitism in DEI for an organization in years. And I just, you know, I think that there's obviously the idea that we're white and we're not a minority, and it's a huge misconception. And I recently had a friend reach out to me who is an ally and say, you know...
For people who are not seeing it, you air quoted the word ally. I want to know why, but let me hear your story first. Yeah.
Okay. It's someone who has, I thought, been an ally mm-hmm. for a long time. And I'll explain at the end. So he said to me, you know, most Jews aren't white. And I said, actually, that's not true. Do you know about Mizrahim? Do you know about Sephardim? Do you know about people in Israel? Do you know the 2/3 are not white, what you'd consider white? And I went on this whole conversation, and he said, well, look in the mirror. And I basically was like, I actually have to go. I'll talk to you later. Because I truly didn't know how to react. It like really hit me. And I don't think it was out of malice. I think it's a miseducation. And it was
Let me ask you, because I think there's a very thin line between malice and miseducation. When children, you know, there's a very huge distance between malice and miseducation. As we grow older, they get closer and closer, and there's a thin line because you can educate yourself and you choose not to. This friend of yours, if they were talking to a non-binary individual, where we're talking to a trans individual, would they have told them, no, you're not X, look at the mirror. No, you're not a man, look in the mirror. No, you're not a woman, look in the mirror.
No, I even recently interviewed an incredible woman. Her name is April Powers. I interviewed her at the museum, and she does incredible work in the DEI space. And she said, would you say this, that kind of a statement, to a white-presenting Latinx person? No, they're a white-presenting, you know, Black person. I mean, they're white-presenting people in all different ethnicities. And just substitute the word Jew, would you say it? And I just think people don't think about that, and it's hurtful. And yes, as children, sure, you don't, you know, you can, children are not born bad. They're not born bad. But I like what you're saying. It's true. At a certain point, you're responsible to educate yourself.
And I think more than that, I think, and I don't know this specific friend of yours, but I think people have a desire or a need to see us as white. especially people from the left side, you know, the extreme left want to see us as right. Just like the extreme right needs to see us as non-white. It's
That's that whole horseshoe, right? Like, during the Holocaust, we weren't white enough. We weren't Aryan. We didn't fit that pure race. And now it's like, we're too white. We're oppressors. So it's like, which is it? Which is it? I mean, I made this comment a while back about how we've somehow managed to unite the left and the far, far left and the far, far right through their mutual hatred of us. And it's like, it's a joke, but it's not. It's not a joke. It's whatever fits the narrative at the time. We've always been a scapegoat for that throughout all of history.
So you had a very interesting experience, I believe, in a way somewhat similar to mine. There are people that have been fighting for Jewish civil rights for years. I've talked with many people who started in 2021, when the previous war in Gaza. Some people started in 2019, some people started before that. Yet, if you scroll on your Instagram account, for example...
That was not what I was talking about.
It was beautiful family pictures, beautiful family pictures, beautiful family pictures, October 7th. Do you remember the first thing that you posted after October 7th?
Yes.
What was it?
I posted a picture of myself, I believe, and now I want to scroll back, but I'm pretty certain I posted a picture of myself wrapped in an Israeli flag outside of Auschwitz.
That's exactly it. Why this? You could have posted many, many different things. People posted videos of themselves angry or crying. People posted the footage of Hamas. People have expressed themselves in words. You just posted a picture of yourself draped in an Israeli flag outside of Auschwitz. Why?
Wow, this is gonna actually make me emotional. I hadn't really thought about like the reasoning behind it. It was just obvious to me.
But it's not obvious.
Yeah, when I think of Israel, Israel's everything to my family. I grew up a very proud Zionist. Israel's afforded a lot to the Jewish people, and without, you know, if we had Israel, would the Holocaust have happened? You know, Israel was this beacon of hope for my family. And I had family members go to Israel. I have a lot of family in Israel. And for me, when I visited Auschwitz, I was able to both enter and exit Auschwitz a free woman, safely wrapped in my Israeli flag. For me, I felt safe in my Israeli flag. It was this symbol to me of, you tried to end us, you tried to stop us, you cannot. We are strong and we have Israel. And we are a light amidst this darkness. And that's what that picture symbolized to me, that we have been here before and we will come out again. And that I am sure of.
So a lot of what I talk with people is understanding people's relationship to Israel and how it's so intertwined, the Jewish identity with the state of Israel, not necessarily the government, not necessarily the policies, not necessarily the application, but the existence of a state of Israel, how that's so intertwined with our Jewish identity and Jewish civil rights. You mentioned Israel being a beacon of hope for your family. What is your immediate connection to Israel? Why Israel? You live in LA. Did you grow up in LA?
I grew up in LA, but we visited Israel frequently. We have family there and a lot of friends. And so it was very important to my parents and my grandparents to take us to Israel often. And I just, some of my greatest memories are going to Israel. And I think for me, it's this beautiful blend of history and also with this like life, like Am Yisrael Chai, is so real. You know, I grew up going to Israel, and people just were alive in this beautiful way. My dad, we'd go out late at night, and you know, it just seeing my grandparents, seeing my parents, especially my dad, just the pure joy in Israel is some of they're some of my greatest memories there. And it was
you recently visited again.
Yes.
This time from what I was following, not so much for joy, but more as a bearing witness.
Yes. So as a grandchild of survivors, I know how important it is to bear witness. It was something I had to do in Eastern Europe and something I felt I had to do again. And I'm very fortunate to American Friends of Sheba Hospital that they, you know, I was able to go to Israel with them and experience it. It was an incredible experience. And it was obviously devastating in many ways. I went to Nir Oz, which is one of the kibbutzim in the south, and we went to the Gaza corridor, spoke to hostage families who I'm now very close to, spoke to survivors, went into Sheba Hospital a few times and spoke with wounded soldiers, and you know, spoke to the doctors who receive hostages, spoke to one of the heads of the people who, this woman who investigates gender-based violence of October 7th and finds the evidence of that. We spoke to a lot of people, and it was so important for me to bear witness. It was equally important for me to see the life of Israel still there in the way that I grew up. Again, Am Yisrael Chai was there. People were on the beaches. People were in the clubs. People were embracing life, because I think that there's this sense of like appreciation for life in a different way than we have here.
And you know, but you and I see it that way, and I completely understand what you're saying. In fact, I'm very soon traveling to Israel. Yet there are people, you know, I hate to say this, but quote unquote, on the other side, who view the same videos. They see us at the beaches, they see at the Tel Aviv restaurants being filled, you're seeing in hotels, celebrations, bar mitzvahs, weddings, and they say, these people are complaining about being in a war. These people are complaining about being persecuted and victimized, yet they seem super happy. They seem like life keeps going. Like, what are they talking about?
Honestly, I don't even know. There are some people that are so brainwashed and so full of hate that they are blind by their hatred, and I don't know if they can be convinced. To me, it's this middle area of people that admittedly don't know enough or can be taught more and shown more information to then maybe realize that this is a matter of darkness and light, a matter of democracy and radical jihadism. So I think I can't even give attention to it, if you know what I mean. Like, I'm not going to convince those people. If that's what they think, like, I don't know. I spent so long caring and trying to, like, scream and fight at these people, and I just had this moment of, like, it's not serving anything. Does that make any sense?
Like, no, I completely. That's part of, you know, I actually think it more about different ways of changing different minds. You know, I have been mostly focusing on talking to Jewish communities and to non-Jewish communities who are interested. Because my view was, we have 16 million Jews around the world. I want all of them fighting in the streets with our allies. Other people have been focusing on talking with the quote-unquote the other side, trying to convince them, pointing at their errors, their mistakes, their lies, their hatred and vitriol. And then there are people that are walking around and looking for those in the middle that have not made up their minds, trying to rein, at least if not pull them in, then make sure that they are not pulled in to the other side. And we each do our own role. That's the whole point of this podcast, that we each have our own community, our own audience, our own goals. So what is your audience? What are your goals?
I feel like it's very similar to what you're talking about. I definitely speak to the Jewish people for sure, but I don't want to also just be in that echo chamber. We need to speak outside to continue to gain more allies. We cannot do this on our own. You know, we're fighting this physical battle on the grounds in Israel. God bless the IDF. I'm beyond grateful. But there's also this social media war and the war against misinformation. And it's we are literally fighting for the hearts and minds of future generations. And it is a huge obligation. And so if I can share, because there's a lot of Jewish people who don't know what to do, or and they're not speaking out, or they're nervous and they're scared, I say, it's a lot of work to put together a whole platform. If you can't do that, amplify other voices. Talk to your friends. And I've done things so far as sitting down with people for lunch or coffee, and because they don't know enough, and spending a couple hours explaining the situation. And I find that to be so impactful. I mean, it meant so much to me. I had a friend from years ago who I talked to reach out to me and say, listen, I'm not going to pretend to understand what's going on. I just see a friend who's hurting, and this was a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And I want to understand more. And I'm not expecting you to be a teacher, but if you'd sit down with me, I'd really love to learn. I was blown away. And I, of course, sat down with her.
So how do you sit down with someone like that? So first of all, I wish more people were open like that to just say, I want to learn, rather than I know, or even the worst that we're seeing now, which is I don't want to know. But you're sitting with someone and you have the opportunity to, you're not even looking to change their mind, to educate them. A lot of people listening would probably want to know, what did you do? There's so many things you can talk about. Where do you start?
So this was know the person. There's a lot of ways to educate people, right? Like some people are responsive to facts. Some people are responsive to getting to their heart and their emotional, you know, pull at their heartstrings. You know, people accept information differently. And it's important to kind of feel it out as you're talking, what they're receiving. But also, I know that she's a Black woman and she's very proud of that. And so for me, sitting down and talking to her, I needed to explain to her the history of allyship between the Black community and the Jewish community. It was something I felt very strongly about going into our conversation. And so it was something I educated on. I talked about Martin Luther King and how we marched. And I spoke about a lot of the Black and Jewish unity in the history of that. And she didn't know. And I think that was really impactful for her. I showed her certain accounts to follow that I felt that she would respond to.
Certain accounts meaning social media accounts.
Yeah, certain social media accounts. And she also talked to me about how, and I knew this was going to be the case because she's in entertainment, most of the people she follow are posting, you know, dead children in Gaza, you know, starving children in Gaza. And that's horrific if that's what you're seeing all day long.
It is horrific. I mean, it's, you know, no one should relish, enjoy, or even look away from from civilian casualties. That doesn't mean that you agree with the reason. Mean that you agree with what people think should be done. But if you cannot feel the pain of the other side, how can you expect the other side to feel your pain?
Exactly. So I have to validate that, which is true. True. I value life, and I hope all Jews do. You know, we should always value life. That's a core tenet of who we are. But I had to explain to her, you know, why it is that way and who is to blame here, and to really use critical thinking when she's seeing these images, and to understand the full picture, not just the one image. And so she also really didn't know much about October 7th. I told her stories about the brutality, about the hostages, about the sexual violence. She didn't know because she's not seeing that stuff. And it was such it was such a mind-blowing experience for me because we're in this echo chamber of people that, like, I walk around. If I were to say the Bibas family to anyone in my community, they know immediately. But I might go down the street and say Bibas family to someone at a coffee shop. They might not know what I'm talking about, which is crazy for me to even think about.
Yes. But that, no, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's almost like the name Emmett Till for an African-American. No explanation needed.
Mm-hmm. And for me, there's no explanation for me with Emmett
right,
Till,
because,
which is how it should be for across cultures. And I think that this is a huge issue, is we're not educated on anyone else's culture either. And so if we care about humanity, that includes everyone. And I just, for me, what I was taught growing up is that we're all equal. We all have one beating heart. You know, I think that the way we look at humanity really needs to be evaluated. No one is better than another person. And I think that's what's so hurtful here, is because people don't really know that Jewish people feel that way. A lot of Jewish people feel that way. Sure, there's like bad apples and whatnot, but that's anywhere. But for the most part, we are sensitive, at least like in my, you know, experience, being from Holocaust survivors, it's like, we experienced so much hate. I'm not gonna put that back in the world. I interviewed a Holocaust survivor today. Most of the survivors I interview, by the way, say the same thing of how we are equal. We need to stop thinking that we're better than one another, that they have hope for the future, but we need to see past color. And it's amazing to see that. And that's how I feel I was raised.
What is, if you heard what I've heard?
Oh, so If You Heard What I Heard is a project I was involved in before. It's telling the stories of third generation survivors, since they're most of the time the last generation to have heard the stories directly from the witnesses themselves. That's what that project is. It's an organization, you know, continuing to try to interview the third generation, kind of like what, you know, Steven Spielberg did with the Shoah series, and my grandparents did that for third generation survivors.
So it does seem like the main theme in what you do is Holocaust education.
Yes.
Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes, but I think that it's for a certain reason, right? Like,
yes, that was my question. What's the reason? You know, what you know, you can educate people about a lot of things. You can engage in Holocaust remembrance, which is different from Holocaust education. Why is that your fixation? Why is that the thing that you are focused on?
Well, for sure, it's in my core. It's in my DNA. I don't remember a day before, and I don't remember a day in my life where I didn't know about the Holocaust. When my papa had a number on his arm, we asked his kids what it meant, and he never shied away from it. And we grew up hearing these stories. But for me, it's a lesson in humanity. I think it can be translated across so many different things, you know, like, we can take away so many lessons from the Holocaust, regardless of your history, your culture, you know, just in terms of humanity. And I think right now we're seeing a lot of parallels to 1930s, to what we're seeing in America now, and it's terrifying. But also, we have to learn from the past to understand the present and where we're going in the future. Because right now we have to see it and make a choice of what we're gonna do differently to ensure this really never happens again. You know, the whole thought of never again is now can't be that way. Like, we have to make it never again, not never again is now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, while there's so many parallels, it's also a different time because we are stronger in a lot of ways. We've become very united very quickly. and we have to speak out. Like everyone, like you said, I want all 15 plus people, million people speaking out. I completely agree with that. We have an obligation.
But there are people that would say, and I've definitely heard this argument in the past months, that when we overuse the Holocaust,
I know where you're going.
In talking about what is happening now, we're not only doing a disservice to now, we're also doing a disservice to those that underwent such a horrific experience, and that we are maybe even overreacting. What do you think about that argument? Shouldn't the Holocaust be something sacred that does not get compared to anything?
Yes, I wouldn't say you have to compare to the Holocaust. I can say that you can learn lessons from before.
Before meaning what?
Before leading up to it, like learning from the type of education, learning where we went wrong, learning to understand how this happened worldwide to make sure we don't get to, I don't think we're gonna get to the point that it got to. Mm-hmm. I don't. But we are seeing this deep-seated hatred of Jews coming out from the sewers everywhere around the world that we were seeing in the 1930s, and it's important to be aware of that, if that makes sense.
So what are you seeing? You spend a lot of time in the Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles. You bring in a lot of very interesting and affected people. What parallels are you seeing?
I'm seeing parallels in the education system. Back then it was just books were being banned. There were protests outside. There were protests outside buildings on colleges in America, protests in the street. The same kind of comments we're seeing today also were being said back then. Mm-hmm. I think education is incredibly important. That's why I am so focused on education. It's not just the Holocaust. It's the 4,000 years of persecution. There are so many pogroms throughout Jewish history. The Holocaust is just the most recent and the largest scale. So people need to know about it, but also need to know it wasn't this standalone moment in history. It was 4,000 years of this. We always persevere and we always thrive and we always continue to live. However, people need to know that we've been persecuted this long. And we continue to see the same trends, the being blamed for various things. We control everything. Back then, we controlled banks. They've always put us into positions and forced us into positions because they were seen as lowly, like bankers and finance. But then we thrive in those spaces, and all suddenly it's bad and we control it and we need to be stopped. Like, we control the media. Well, there was nowhere else for us to go when we came to America. It was seen as more lowly. So we went into the entertainment industry and we made it this beautiful industry. And now we suddenly control the media. Also, I wish we controlled the media because it's really against us right now. So it's
exactly
ridiculous.
On the day that I was testifying in Congress, and I think a day or two before, AOC said something about AIPAC controlling Congress. And I said, hey, if AIPAC controlled Congress, then this room would be filled with Congress members. There were maybe 9 of them out of 44.
Yes.
So I wish we controlled Congress so they would actually take me more seriously.
But I was about to say what else was similar in the past is the denial. The denial.
Denial of what?
Of the events that took place. I don't know how. I will never fully understand how people deny the Holocaust with the amount of evidence that were there. The Nazis documented it themselves. Just like today, Hamas documented it themselves, and people still deny it. Yeah, I don't understand it. They'll say there was no sexual violence. It didn't happen. I mean, it does not make sense to me. My brain is trying to understand the fourth dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another parallel we're seeing today. I mean, it's just even the media, how the media portrays things. I mean, there's so many similarities in that regard. And in terms of the diaspora, like something that happened in Israel should not have spiked 400% anti-Semitism in America. You know, like the fact that that happened proves that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And I'm so sick of the argument that it's not. It's just a new term wrapped in a bow to make their propaganda better, you know, to justify it.
And you've been obviously talking and interviewing many survivors of the Holocaust. How do they see this moment? What's their reaction? Do they see everything that's happening and say, "Oh, here we go again," or do they see and saying, "Well, at least it's not as bad"? Or maybe there's different opinions, different reactions. How are people that live through this?
Of course, there are different opinions, as with everything. You know, even after the Holocaust, how people moved forward, it's very different. Like my family chose to, you know, see light and create a beautiful life again. And some people sat and were very traumatized and could not move forward. There's always going to be different opinions, but I would say almost everyone I talk to, it's really beautiful because they'll speak to how difficult it is to see. They're sick over it. It's so hard. Like what they're seeing on college campuses particularly is very difficult. But when I ask them what their message is for the future and how they maintain hope for the future, they're always hopeful. I don't know anyone I've spoken to who said, "Well, there's no hope and we're doomed." Every single one has said, as long as we are united and we view everyone as equal, we are going to be okay. There is hope. Absolutely. With unequivocally, they tell me that there is hope.
That is something that I understand rationally and I cannot understand emotionally. What? How does someone who has gone through the gates of hell and back and now starts seeing glimmers of that again can remain hopeful? What can we learn from them?
I mean, listen, I don't know. I don't think they're like going to forgive and forget. But what's the alternative, right? Like, I always ask, you know, how did you believe in God when you were sitting in Auschwitz being ripped away from your mother or your little sister to never see her again? How do you believe in God? How do you have hope in a moment like that? And it's like, how could I not? What is my alternative? If I have no belief in God, if I have no hope for a future, then there's no reason to live. And that's, I think, how I feel as well. I'm very much in agreement with that. And I try to focus on considering this, you know, the kids on college campus and all these miseducated people as a loud minority. I'm really holding on to that. And I know that so many people do stand with us. I wish that they would be way more vocal. Mm-hmm. We need more people vocal. It is scary that the loud minority is also the future. Future politicians, future, you know, heads of companies.
But well, they don't have to be. We can fight it. We can put our own leaders and politicians and CEOs and media moguls and whatever. That is part of the Jewish fight.
Really? But I would be lying if I said I don't have really hard days. You know, the trauma is always there, right? I think it's always going to be there for us, just as it always has been for the Holocaust survivors.
So what do you do on your...
But the survival is also there.
And so what do you do on the dark days?
Try to get off social media a little bit.
No, I mean, I'm asking seriously because, again, the idea of this podcast is someone listening in or watching us who cares deeply, Jewish or non-Jewish, realizes that this is a big problem, wants to act, even maybe knows how to act, because there's different, I've interviewed different guests and everyone fights in a different way. But some days they cannot get out of bed because it's overwhelming. How do you get them out of bed? How do you yourself get out of bed?
I've had days like that. Community. When I have days like that, I have to reach out to someone in my community because they're probably not having a day like that and I need some support. And then when they have a day like that, I can give the support. I think community is everything. And even when we're all having a dark day, you know, there's a day recently where a lot of soldiers were killed. I think grieving together, I can't do it alone. I cannot do this fight alone. And having community for me it's everything.
Yeah. So I'm not a religious person, and you know, I've been very open about that. And actually, it's important to me to be open about that, to show that there's different ways of being strongly Jewish and yet not religious. I recently read a book called Living a Year of Kaddish. Kaddish obviously being the prayer of mourning, of grieving, that Jews say. And for observant Jews, for Orthodox Jews, you're supposed to say the Kaddish for 11 months after someone passes away, three times a day. And you're supposed to go and say it with a minyan. A minyan meaning nine or more other individuals. You know, Orthodox would say they have to be men and they have to be Jewish men. Conservative Reform, to me, it doesn't matter who you're with. But the idea that for 11 months, you want it or you don't want it, you have to force yourself to put yourself out there in the community, show that you're vulnerable. Because if you're not showing people that you're vulnerable, if you're not showing people that sometimes life sucks for you and you need their help, they won't know how to help you. So it sounds like what you're expressing is something like that. That if we want to fight anti-Semitism, if we want to fight for Jewish civil rights, we have to create a community for ourselves, and we also have to show our community that we need them. Not just that we're there for them, but also sometimes, hey, I need you here with me.
I think it's good to be vulnerable. I think as Jewish people, we've always created community. And I think that that's what, you know, keeps us together. Then like being in Israel for me was, I think that's why it was so meaningful. Like that was really important for me to feel that everyone around me I knew felt the same way. Everyone's walking around with this like trauma underneath them. We are literally sitting Shiva still for a very long time. And that is living there. And at the same time, we're trying to have Jewish joy and finding Jewish joy. And that's through connecting, and that's through being in community. And, you know, we were talking in Israel about how in Israel, I don't have to whisper. And that was so powerful to me. You know, in Israel, I sit at a table, I start talking about what's happening, and I don't know what the table next to me is thinking. And in Israel, I could talk about it, and the table next to me would join in. And there was something really beautiful about that. And really, in a war zone, I felt more at peace than I had in a long time. And it was because I had community. So finding that community here, it's critical.
I find what you just said so insightful. In Israel, I didn't have to whisper. I would say in a community that supports you, you don't have to whisper. And if my fight succeeds, and I don't know exactly what my fight is, but if my fight succeeds, no one, no matter Jew or non-Jew, no one will ever have to whisper ever again.
Absolutely. And when I was in Israel, I remember exactly where I was. I had this moment of like, I'm done living in doomsday. I mean, I was with another friend and I turned to her and I sat up and I was like, I'm done with this. Like I've spent so many months understandably living in this like darkness and sharing things as they came in that were dark. And I was like, I need to live in the light. Listen, there are still people being killed. There are still hostages. There are things that need to be discussed, and they are dark things. But we also need to have hope. Without that, we can't survive. And so when we hear of hostages who have tragically been killed, or we hear of soldiers who have been killed, my posts now are not, these soldiers were killed, these hostages were killed. It's, let's celebrate their life. And I share photos of them, and I share about their life. And I always have the families, you know, saying thank you. And I think that that is so important to me and important for the community to remember.
Yes, and you know what? With that in mind, I want to mention, after the four hostages were rescued, and tragically, unfortunately, one commander, a soldier, was killed, Arnon Zmora, we had a rally in Times Square organized by End Jew Hatred and a few other organizations. And after we held our rally, we had some sort of memorial service for Arnon Zmora, and we each held pictures of him, not in his IDF uniform, not right before he went into battle, but of him with his kids, of him at the beach, of him like having a good time, because you're not defined by your end. You're not defined by those who kill you. You're defined by how you lived.
Exactly. And that is why, for me, it's important to share those stories. It's important, just as it's important for me to share people's lives before the Holocaust, not just their life didn't start in 1939. People had beautiful lives before. Just like the soldier isn't defined by just his death, defined by his life. And it's important for me to really share that. And that's a part of finding light in the darkness.
And we owe an immense debt to Arnon Zmora and to all the other fallen soldiers. What is a book that you would recommend, a book or a movie, for people who want to educate themselves more about Israel, about Jewish life, about the Jewish diaspora, about the fight for Jewish civil rights?
I think Noah Tishby's book is really helpful. I think she really says it pretty clearly, and that's important.
Noah Tishby, she has two books now, so
you're referring... Yeah, you've had a chance to read her second, but I think that she does it in a digestible way.
It was so Israel, the most misunderstood country in the world.
Oh. Yeah.
Do you have a book or a movie that you would recommend people to read about the Holocaust or the years that led up to the Holocaust?
That's a really good question. I just finished We Were the Lucky Ones recently. And I really liked that a lot. And I'm going to recommend that as a show because it's on now. Like it's... Uh-huh. Easy for people to see, and it's modern. So yes, you could go back to Schindler's List. A Beautiful Life is one of my favorite movies in the entire world. I love that movie. Life is Beautiful, not A Beautiful Life. That's a very different situation. Welcome to me being immersed in Christmas.
Yes.
Life is Beautiful is an incredible movie, one of my favorite movies. We Were the Lucky Ones, which is on now and easy to find, I thought did a really nice job.
All right. So I like to end every episode with what I've been calling a Jewish lightning round, a list of questions. There are no right or wrong answers. Just say the first thing that comes up to mind. You get one pass and I get to decide whether you get the pass.
Oh, no. I'm not going to be good at this. And I'm a perfectionist.
The point is not being good. The point is being honest. And I have a feeling that you will be very, very good because you're very honest.
Oh, gosh.
Amanda, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I'm a vegetarian, but my family owns a deli.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We've value life. We want to live. We don't want to hurt others.
What is your favorite curse?
Fuck. Is that what you mean?
I don't know. What's your favorite curse?
Like a curse word?
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck, for sure.
When was the last time you cried?
Today.
You want to share?
I always cry when I'm with a Holocaust survivor, and I interviewed a Holocaust survivor today. But today was a hopeful cry. It was a hope for the future that I needed.
The best kind of crying. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
I really would wish I could see my grandparents. It's more than one person, but yeah. I want them to see what I'm doing today.
I have a sense they would be proud of you. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Maybe Passover.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur.
When do you feel safest?
With my family.
When do you feel least safe?
During.
When I have no Jews around me.
That was, give me a second. That's a, wow.
It's true.
What gives you hope?
My children.
I've never met your children, but I've seen pictures and they look beautiful.
They are being raised very proud of their Jewish heritage.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
To a really good question. Sheba Hospital.
Sheba Hospital is the biggest hospital in Israel and actually in the entire Middle East. And it serves Jews, Christians, Muslims, and people from the West Bank, people from Gaza, anyone who needs medical attention.
They're really important more than ever right now.
Amanda, where can people find you?
On Instagram, mainly at amanda.markowitz. I was hacked. My Amanda Markowitz one was hacked, so now I have a dot in between. Sorry.
All right. It's at amanda.markowitz.
Yes.
Listen, this was a fascinating conversation, and if I could say there were three themes that came up, it's community, it's education, and it's light. And I think you embody all three of them in the most resilient and beautiful way. So I thank you very much. And here I am with Amanda Markowitz.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."